discover the tips and strategies that will help you achieve your retirement goals. I'm your host, James Knoll, and this is the podcast dedicated to helping you retire well. It all starts right here on Ready for Retirement. And welcome back to another episode of Ready for Retirement. I'm your host, James Knoll. Before we jump into today, one more reminder. I've been talking about it the last few episodes, but our YouTube channel is live, and not just live, it's been live for a while, but actually has some videos being posted to it, at least one per week, as well as another audio version of this podcast here that is posted directly to YouTube. So if you are enjoying this resource and if you would like more resources, then check out our YouTube page. It is under Root Financial Partners, R-O-O-T, Root Financial Partners. It's the name of the financial planning company I run, and that is where you can find more content on YouTube. So that's that. Now back to the podcast. Today, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be going through a listener question. And I actually got this question on another podcast and I thought it was a great question to also answer here. So I'm going to pull that question in. So here's the question. The question says, I manage my mom's finances. She's 70 years old, and while she has not yet drawn down her IRAs, which are worth $2.8 million, I keep about 2.5 years worth of cash for her in those accounts and otherwise aim for 60% stocks in those portfolios. Do you have recommendations about when to rebalance? Given that I won't be rebalancing every day, do you have a range you'd recommend for rebalancing for someone aiming to have 60% of their portfolio in stocks? Good question. So we know that rebalancing is important. The question is, how often do we rebalance? Is there some time frame in which we should be setting reminders or doing something to rebalance our accounts? Well, historically, this is kind of exactly the way it was done. People would set their portfolio allocation, and then once per year or once every 6 months or whatever time frame they chose, they would go in and rebalance. But that's not the best way to do it. It's not the worst way to do it. It's a good thing that it's happening, but it's not the best way. And here's an example of why. Let's assume that you do have that 60-40 portfolio, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, and let's assume that you rebalance it once per year. Well, let's assume over the course of the year, the stock portion of your portfolio is up 5% and the bond portion of your portfolio is up 5%. Well, if you go to rebalance, then you can do it, but you're going to be rebalancing from a 60-40 portfolio to a 60-40 portfolio. Nothing's going to have changed. The total value of the portfolio has changed, but what you're looking for is the relative allocation to each of the investments that you have. And if they're all increasing or decreasing at the same exact rate, then whatever the allocation was at the beginning, so 60-40 in this example, is going to be the exact same allocation at the end of this period, so still 60-40. Where rebalancing is effective is when you have differences in the different types of asset classes in terms of how they're performing. So let's now look at another example where, say, for example, in the midst of that 12-month period, the asset classes are both up 5%. But let's say that 6 months into that, and this is going to be an extreme example, but let's say that at a 6-month mark, stocks had shot way up and they were up maybe 50% and bonds were down 20%. Well, at that moment in time, you're no longer going to have a 60-40 portfolio. The stock portion is going to be much higher, and the bond portion is going to be much lower. I don't know what the exact numbers are. I'm just kind of making these numbers up as we go, but it might look more like a 70-30 portfolio at that point. Well, what then happens over the next 6 months is things revert back to where they were. And by the end of the 12 months, they're both just up 5%. Well, you missed your chance to rebalance at that point. The chance to rebalance would have been at the 6-month mark when the 60-40 portfolio had turned into a 70-30 portfolio. So what this shows is time frame is not necessarily the best thing to rebalance. You would have missed that in this case. Sometimes if you're just doing a rebalance once every year, in some cases you could be rebalancing too frequently just because there's not enough relative variation between the different types of investments. In other cases, however, you might not be rebalancing enough if there's a significant change within the different types of asset classes within the years. We could look at March of 2020 to illustrate this for us. March of 2020, if you had bonds in your portfolio and if you had stocks in your portfolio, they had performed very differently. Had you rebalanced out of a portion of your bonds and into a portion of stocks at that time, that would have been, in retrospect, a great thing to do, because you were taking money from the bond portion that had stayed more stable, buying into the stock portion, which had gone down quite a bit, and in doing so, when the stocks recovered, you had more stocks going up in value because of that rebalance. So what we see, what all the literature and all the studies show, is that rebalancing based upon time frame is okay. What's better is rebalancing based upon variance. Meaning, instead of choosing a date on which you're going to rebalance, choose a variance. Meaning, if you have a target allocation, say of 50% stocks, 50% bonds, maybe I assign a variance of 20% to both asset classes. Meaning, if the stock portion goes up or down 20%, and not 20% in the sense it goes from 50% to 70 or 50% to 30, but 20% of 50%, which would be a 10% drift in either direction. What that tells me is if the portion of my stock portfolio ever increases above 60% or declines below 40%, that's going to trigger a rebalance. And what you do is you can assign those variances or that target threshold, that target band, to each of the different investments you have. I'm using a very simple example, just stocks and bonds. But the reality is you probably have many different types of stocks. Big companies, small companies, international companies, domestic companies, real estate maybe. And you might even have different types of bonds. So if you assign a variance threshold to each of those, once the actual allocation drifts away from the target allocation by a certain percentage, which most literature will show somewhere between 10 to 20%, that's the point at which you should be rebalancing. Now, the second question, this is the practicality of it all. You know, this is easy for me to say. I have software that can track on a daily basis. How far out of balance is any given portfolio? And so that makes it very easy. Chances are, if you're looking at your portfolio, you don't have software attached to it that every single day is sending you alerts of whether you need to rebalance or not. So if you look at this and say, okay, great, I get it that the variance and the target allocation and having some sort of a reference point for how far this can stray is the best way to do it. If you're tracking your portfolio consistently to do it, that's probably the best way. If you're saying, you know what, that's just too much hassle, I know that I'm not going to do it, doing it by date, putting a date on the calendar of every 12 months or every 6 months or whatever you prefer, that's still going to be better than nothing. It's just maybe not the most effective way. Now, I'm going to take this even a step further because there's a second part of this question coming up. But before it comes up, I'm going to preface it by painting a picture here. So here's why you even rebalance in the first place. Depending upon your initial mix of investments, whether it's all stocks or all bonds or part stocks and part bonds, in some cases, rebalancing helps to increase returns. Data will show that if you rebalance consistently, it helps to increase your returns. Other times, though, it just helps to manage risk. And how does it do that? Well, if you have a 50-50 portfolio or say a 60-40 portfolio, if you never rebalance, well, over time, stocks tend to outperform bonds. So what's going to happen is that 60-40 portfolio is going to start drifting. It's not going to happen overnight. But at some point, it's going to be a 65-35 portfolio, then a 70-30 portfolio, then an 80-20 portfolio. And the longer you let it keep running, the further and further it's going to skew towards the stock or the equity portion, and the farther away it's going to skew from the bond portion. So to rebalance a 60-40 portfolio probably is not going to increase returns, and returns would actually be better over time if you didn't rebalance because you're going to have more and more stock, which tends to do better and better over time, but it is going to help you manage risk. So with that being said, let's jump into the second portion of this question so I can tie it back to this. The second portion of this listener's question, she says, my mom is very comfortable with her retirement between her Social Security, her pension, and the survivor's pension she receives from my late father and other assets. Total assets are about $3.7 million, with most of that being the $2.8 million in traditional IRA. Every year, my mom generously funds Roth IRAs for my sister and me, and she contributes some money to 529 accounts for her grandchildren. She's interested in leaving a legacy for her family and curious of other estate planning options. Our family friend suggested that she fund annuities for her grandchildren. While the 529 accounts are not overfunded at this point, I'm mindful that I don't want too much tied into those since they have to be used for educational expenses. Curious about your thoughts on the annuity option or any other estate planning options for my mom. Well, I have a lot of thoughts on this, and actually there's some really significant planning opportunities that exist here. The first one, though, is this. I'm going to go back to the first sentence here. You say, my mom is very comfortable with her retirement between her Social Security, her pension, and the survivor's pension she receives from my late father and other assets. Well, now let's go back to what I just mentioned, of rebalancing doesn't actually improve performance. It mitigates risk. So let's go back to this listener's mom's question or situation. She has $2.8 million in an IRA. If 40% is in bonds, that's about $1.1 million that she has in bonds. Bonds are good in the sense that that money is readily available. Even if the stock market is falling, it provides some stable liquidity. But I'm going to go back to how much does she need? She mentioned that between her Social Security pension and survivor's pension, she has pretty much all of her needs met. Now, that's not to say don't invest in bonds, but I'm mentioning this. And by the way, this is not a recommendation. This is just something I want to unpack and something we want to explore. She mentioned that one of her mom's main interests at this point is leaving a legacy for her family. So, could it possibly make sense to intentionally not rebalance, to intentionally not decrease the amount of bonds in the portfolio? That could stay stable at $1.1 million and actually keep growing if she's not touching it. But instead of continuing to rebalance, as stocks go up, rebalance back into bonds, let that start to drift. Because as that starts to drift, it will actually enhance the return potential, and it's doing so in a way where your mom doesn't necessarily need these funds. And I'm putting needs kind of in air quotes here because I'm just looking at this from a purely pragmatic standpoint of Social Security pension and survivor's pension covering all of her needs. So if she's trying to make sure that her retirement is secure while also thinking about legacy, that could be a great place to start as thinking about her overall asset allocation. Don't go out and sell out all the bonds, but do you let the stock portion drift over time to become a higher and higher amount, which just leads to more and more growth, which means more options for legacy and more that money can do for your mom, not just over her lifetime, but over her family's lifetime with her legacy. So that's the first thing I might think about if legacy is a big concern, is don't look at asset allocation just from the standpoint of retirement security. That's certainly a great place to start, but it looks like that box is checked in many ways. And once that box is checked, then you can start thinking about legacy options and letting this portfolio be more of a reflection of that while not neglecting the retirement income that it also needs to generate. Now, here's the second thing that your mom can look to do here. What I would look at is, what is your mom's tax bracket? What will it be now? And what will it be when she starts taking required minimum distributions? Because if your mom is in a low tax bracket today, and by the way, I have no idea how much income is coming in from Social Security and pensions, but if she happens to be in a relatively low tax bracket, could it make sense to start doing conversions? One, this could potentially help your mom and could potentially help to expand the after-tax benefit of the money that she has in her IRA. But number two, it's not just comparing her tax bracket today with her tax bracket when required distributions start, but it's also about comparing her tax bracket today to the tax bracket of her beneficiaries. So you as her daughter and other beneficiaries. Why this matters is, again, assuming that she already has a retirement security in place, which is absolutely the first goal here. If the secondary goal is to expand upon the legacy that this can provide, if she is able to do conversions today and start shifting funds into Roth IRAs today, what that's going to do is save beneficiaries from having to pay any taxes on that in the future. So it's not just comparing mom's tax bracket today with mom's tax bracket in the future. It's about mom comparing her tax bracket today with her beneficiary's tax bracket in the future, which granted is probably a much more challenging task. What you're having to do then is you're having to figure out where a tax bracket's going to be in the next 30 plus years, assuming mom lives a long, healthy life, and we just don't know. But if you want to almost think of this as tax insurance, how can I willingly pay some money in taxes today to not have to worry about taxes and what they're going to be in the future? That could potentially be a great way to do it so that it's Roth accounts she's passing on in the future, not traditional accounts. Now, another thing with that, since the SECURE Act passed, you no longer have the ability to take what's called a stretch IRA. It used to be that if you inherited an IRA, you could stretch your required minimum distributions out over the course of your lifetime. So when you have your own personal traditional IRA, you have to start taking funds out of that at age 72, and the amount you take out each year is based upon your life expectancy based upon IRS tables. So that starts at 72 and goes all the way until the time that you pass. Well, if you inherit an IRA, even if you're not 72, even if you're only 22, the day that you inherit that IRA, you immediately have to start taking required minimum distributions by the end of the following year. Well, the SECURE Act changed that. what happened is instead of you being able to start required distributions from an inherited IRA starting the year after the original account holder had passed away, you now have 10 years to fully distribute the account. So instead of being able to take a small amount out over the course of your lifetime, you have 10 years where you must fully drain the account. Now, I ran some calculation here. Let's assume, and of course we hope this is not the case, but assume that your mother were to pass away today. That's $2.8 million that she has in her IRA. If that money keeps growing, and I'm just using a growth rate of 6% per year, then if you were her sole beneficiary, and I don't know who her beneficiaries are, but if you were the sole beneficiary, you would have to take out $380,000 per year to fully withdraw it over 10 years. Now, you don't have to take it out like that. You could take it all out right away. You could take it all out in year 10. But if you wanted to evenly spread it out, you would have to take out $380,000 per year to fully withdraw it. Now, assume that your mom's beneficiaries, assume it's you, assume that you're in a high tax bracket. Well, if you're in a high tax bracket and you live in a state like I do, which is California, that $380,000, keep in mind that stacks on top of other income, not just in California, but in all states, that's $380,000 on top of your wages and any other income you have. It could potentially be down to about $200,000 that are left each year after taxes each year for 10 years. So it's a pretty significant hit that you might take if you're in a high tax bracket and you inherit an IRA. You no longer have the stretch IRA provisions that would allow you to take that over the course of your lifetime. So what do you do? Well, sometimes nothing. Sometimes that's just the way it is. It's a good problem to have. You are inheriting a significant asset. You're going to pay taxes. Sometimes though, if the decedent is charitably inclined, and if they want to be able to pass their money to their children and have that money spread out over a period of time, you could consider establishing something called a charitable remainder trust. In a charitable remainder trust, and by the way, there are a ton of details and requirements to do this right, and in many situations, it just does not work, but it's something to be aware of. When you have significant amount in pre-tax accounts that you want to pass to future generations, and you don't want all that money to have to come out in 10 years and have a good portion of it paid in taxes, you could name a charitable remainder trust the beneficiary of your IRA. What then happens is your children, the beneficiaries would be the beneficiary of the charitable remainder trust. So you pass, the money goes into the charitable remainder trust. The charitable remainder trust has to distribute income from it to its beneficiaries every single year, as long as those beneficiaries are living. So what happens is you're not gifting the money outright to children, you're gifting it to the charitable remainder trust, which the children are then beneficiaries of, and they could potentially take income from that 20, 30 plus years and keep doing so until they are no longer living. And then at the end of it, any remaining assets get distributed directly to the charity. So in many ways, it can be a win-win. It's not forcing a fully taxable account to be distributed over a short time frame. It is stretching out those distributions. It's giving funds to a charity. And in many cases, the original beneficiaries are actually receiving more money in an after-tax basis this way, because they're able to stretch this out over a period of several years and not to pay as high of taxes on that, as opposed to receiving the full amount but having to distribute over 10 years. So again, I want to reiterate, there are a lot of requirements for this. In many cases, it does not make sense, but it certainly makes sense to explore if you have a significant amount in pre-tax accounts and if the beneficiaries of that IRA are in high tax brackets themselves. So far with this is you're looking at mom's account. And of course, I'm sure you're doing this with mom and she's looking at her account. And if legacy is one of her primary goals, the two biggest things that stick out to me are how does she think about her asset allocation in light of that? And should the asset allocation both reflect her priorities as well as her beneficiaries' future goals? And then number two, tax planning. Can you start to do Roth conversions? Can she start to shift money into Roth accounts, looking at her tax bracket compared to an estimate of where beneficiaries might be in the future so that more money is being taxed or being passed along tax-free as opposed to in a taxable way, and even looking at modifying beneficiaries if doing so could potentially allow for more after-tax income to be sent to beneficiaries over time. Going back to the question, a couple things here. It says that a family friend suggested that she fund annuities for her grandchildren. Now, I don't know what these annuities look like, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say that's probably very much not what I would recommend here. Anytime you have an annuity, what you are doing is you are making a trade-off. You are shifting risk to an insurance company. And that insurance company is saying, we'll take your money. We will guarantee you some level of income or some guaranteed growth here. But in exchange for that, there's an opportunity cost that you're giving up. Now, for some people in retirement, and by the way, that what I mean by that opportunity cost is they're taking something off the top. They just have to. That's how they stay in business, is they're able to take a portion of what that money could be invested at, give you the remaining portion as a guarantee. And in many cases, they're able to do that because an annuity company has an infinite time horizon. Meaning they don't have a constrained time horizon like many retirees do. Where if you're a retiree and you want to protect against sequence of return risk, or if you want a guaranteed income, or if you're just afraid of the stock market or whatever it might be, you have a finite time horizon. Well, an annuity company says, give us your money. We don't have that finite time horizon. We can allow our money to be invested and be fully taken advantage of what markets can do. In exchange for that, we'll give you a guarantee that's less than what you could get over time, but you might not have the time needed to realize some of these gains. Now, that's a very simplistic way of explaining it. Obviously, there's a lot more details to it. But with that in mind, the people who could potentially benefit from an annuity are people in retirement. If you are looking to fund something for grandchildren, I'm guessing that grandchildren are significantly younger than retirement age. What is the biggest thing they have going for them at this time in terms of what they can build financially? It's time. When you look at compound interest over time, it is incredible what that can do. So if this is me, I am not doing anything that could potentially get in the way of that compounding. What could get in the way of the compounding? Well, using an annuity, which is not going to be able to generate as much growth over time as the stock market is. So I would stay away from that. I would say, how can I fund things that have the most growth potential over time? And an annuity probably isn't the best way to do that. Almost certainly not going to be the best way to do that. So I hope that was helpful. Thank you for this question. Again, I'm borrowing this question from another podcast that I have. So I just thought it would be helpful to explore this, not just from the retirement planning standpoint, but from a legacy standpoint and an overall wealth preservation and really wealth transfer standpoint. What's the best thing to do for myself, for children, for grandchildren, and exploring financial planning from that angle as well. So thank you, as always, for listening. If you haven't done so already, check us out on YouTube. You can go to YouTube and look up Root Financial Partners, where you can find videos about all things retirement planning and investing. Make sure that if you haven't done so already, you're subscribed to this podcast. If you haven't done so, please leave a review. It helps more people find the show. It leads more people to listen to the show so we can help more and more people over time. And as always, thank you for listening. Always enjoy doing this with you. I'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Ready for Retirement podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe and let me know by leaving a 5-star review. And as always, for a list of the notes and the resources mentioned in today's episode, you can find those at the Ready for Retirement website, which is readyforretirement.co. That's readyforretirement.co. And if you have a question that you would like for me to answer in a future episode, then you can also go to the Ready for Retirement website, readyforretirement.co. There's a page called Submit Your Question, where you can submit a question for me to answer in a future episode. Thanks as always for listening, and I'll see you next time. Hey everyone, it's me again for the disclaimer. Please be smart about this. Before doing anything, please be sure to consult with your tax planner or financial planner. Nothing in this podcast should be construed as investment, tax, legal, or other financial advice. It is for informational purposes only.